The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to the show for another week. I'm Stephen Scott, back with you here on The Weekly Connect. Yes, this is the programme that talks to you if you're blind or partially sighted and you've got something you want to say about life with sight loss. And hey, if you don't have sight loss but you know someone who does, hey, this is a platform for you as well. You can get in touch with us and we'll give you all the contact details shortly. But first, let me tell you what's coming up this hour. We hear one man's story of losing his sight and the impact it had on his family, life and career. But why is Chris Downey enjoying life so much? Find out shortly. Also, he may host a weekly radio show on RNIB Connect Radio, all about books and his love of reading. And he may even be an accomplished author. But did you know that blind man Red Sail is also a rock climber? We'll find out how that works later. And also, if you are the parent of a blind child, you might want to know there's an organisation out there helping blind children to learn all about music. Find out about our Society of the Week this hour.
The Weekly Connect. The Weekly Connect. On RNIB Connect Radio.
Yeah, back with you again for another week. Hello, I am Stephen Scott, I'm your host, and yeah, lots to get through this week. We start with an email, though. This comes from Sharon, who says, "Dear Stephen, I really love listening to the Weekly Connect presented by you and the team. However, I note that iTunes hasn't had any recent podcasts since the 11th of April. Is this correct, or are iTunes being lax?" Well, I hope to hear more podcasts soon. Kind regards, Sharon. Well, the good news is it's nothing to do with iTunes. In fact, no, a series of bank holidays has gotten our way over the past couple of weeks. It's the joys of being on a Monday. But we are back this week, and we thank you for noticing that, and we thank you for listening as well. It is indeed your programme. If there's anything you want to say, Sharon, please do get in touch and tell us about it. If you just enjoy listening, then, well, you know what? Do that as well. Really appreciate you getting in touch, and hopefully you enjoy our new episode, which is starting right now. And we begin with Chris Downey, who is an architect, planner and consultant who lost his sight back in 2008. He now spends his time working to create helpful and enriching environments for blind and partially sighted people like him. He's been talking to Simon Pauly.
Hello, Chris.
Hi, Simon.
First of all, I need to ask you, Chris, what is San Francisco like as a city?
Oh, it's a fabulous city. But I've been here since 1989, and I've found it to be an exciting and fantastic city since I've lost my sight. There's a lot going on here. There's a lot of transportation, a lot of options. I can get virtually anywhere, get out to the airports, all sorts of places independently. And so it's really worked out well. And even the city is in San Francisco, it really works well as a pedestrian, blind pedestrian walking around. It's very navigationable and works very well.
Now, take us back to 2008, Chris, because you lost your sight very quickly, didn't you?
Yes. I had had been diagnosed with a tumor located right at the optic nerves and had surgery to remove it. And the doctors didn't anticipate sight loss, but lost all sight in both eyes 2 days after the surgery. So it was, unexpected total. And so it's quite a shock. I hadn't really prepared for it, thought much about it, and had no experience with sort of what that might mean.
Did you feel cheated?
No, not really. You know, I come from a family where my dad, was a doctor, and he had a brain tumor and passed away from complications from brain surgery. So I sort of knew on one hand, knew the dangers, but also respected the profession. You know, they're not wizards. They do some amazing things, but it's life, it's reality, and there's just no guarantee. So I tried not to think about being slighted by having bad luck. I really tried to sort of quickly adopt a more positive, forward-looking attitude to really try to build from there.
So did you channel your frustration and anger into something positive then?
Yes. Well, first, it takes a while for the training to kick in. And I had been an avid cyclist before losing my sight and had even gone up riding around through the Oakland Hills the weekend before my surgery. So I quickly got my bike put on rollers in my living room. And as soon as the surgeon would let me up on the bike, I was I was spending on that just to sort of keep the anxious energy going and just release some of that sort of anxiety and sort of eagerness to get things moving. And really, really pushed hard. You know, I went back to work a month after the surgery. So my training hadn't even kicked in yet, but I knew there were things that I could do, and I wanted to get into the office and start figuring it out and sort of getting back with the life as I knew it in every possible way I could.
How did that affect you then at work then? Did people's attitude towards you change?
Well, you know, it's a shock for everyone. Nobody expected it. You know, I sort of treated it as I'm going in for a surgery, major and significant, but you know, I didn't really anticipate any problems. So when things didn't go as perfectly as we would think, it was a shock to the people I worked with, shock to friends and family. But I'd have to say that everyone was very positive about that. And even the people in the office, you know, the architects, you know, in many ways you would think architects would think, oh my God, you can't see anymore. You're out of here. the other way of looking at it is that they're inherently creative and optimistic people. They're trained in the realm of possibility. And I think that I actually was in a very good place with very positive, very creative, very sort of opportunistic people thinking that, you know, we think he can actually make something out of this and make good on it. They didn't necessarily know how. And it actually turned out to be pretty interesting because I had some of my, like my technology trainer who is blind, he would come to my office for my training sessions, and he's been blind since birth. So I didn't think about it at the time, but it was perfect to have him go in because his level of independence and ability, you know, would sort of reset their expectations to think, oh, there's a lot here that's possible. And they were really impressed with what he could do, how he got around, and how independently he got around and worked on the computers and got through the office. And so that, I actually think that really helped a lot.
And of course, the office have to learn some new habits, not to leave things lying about and things like that, don't they?
Oh, yeah. There really was very little change. I'd say the biggest change was for the office manager whose job it was, especially before I started having training, it was his job to sort of take me down the hall through the building to go find the bathroom. So other than that, he probably had the only real change in the office in terms of what he did and what sort of things. But you know, there's little things here and there, but not much.
Now, you're saying you went to work a month after your surgery. That's traveling as a blind person and, you know, a month before you've been sighted. So what was the difference?
I would get there, my wife would drive me there and get me into the office, and then I'd pretty much go into my office space, and I'd get around less. I used to get around so much more, sort of checking. I was responsible for running the office, so I'd get around and working with staff. In this case, staff came to me most of the time, although I quickly got to the point where I could get around to them and work with them at their desk. But what I thought was kind of interesting about it was, you know, I was having my orientation and mobility training at the same time. And here I was as an architect who had been trained to really think about and be aware of space, be aware of the environment around you and really study it as part of your work. And now I was starting to study it with things other than my eyes and experiencing sort of the more multi-sensory experience of architecture and space. And I quickly started relating sort of the experiences, things that I could sense moving around the building and moving around the streets where I was familiar. You know, I could relate that spatial, acoustic, and tactile experience with my known visual experience of those same spaces. And it was really interesting to start doing that, but also that started forming a new way of thinking about architecture, at least for me, that was pretty positive and interesting in that it made me feel like by doing that, by focusing on these other senses as well, it actually made for better architecture that was more about the full physical experience and not just, as I used to say, not just the eye candy of what the thing looked like. So it was actually a pretty interesting intellectual experience as well as a personal experience, and I think actually helping to make my architecture more well-rounded.
It's funny, isn't it? Because we tend to think of a building being accessible for wheelchairs and also laid out in a way for blind people. Do you think that if we actually thought a bit more about making things more accessible for everybody, it just makes it a better place?
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. And I also think that it's more realistic. It's less of a fantasy. You know, it's fantasy to think that everybody walks around on two legs, sees with two eyes, and hears with two ears, and has the same experience as what people tend to think as being normal. It's just not the way life is. And I think we all do ourselves a disservice, especially in the profession of architecture, when we fail to think about the full lifespan of the human experience, as well as the many different experiences that can be had within one's life.
So it sounds like you took what we would think is a negative experience, but you turned it around into something that's going to be a positive experience.
Absolutely. I think professionally it's been a positive experience. My role in the profession, the work that I do, it's all more meaningful now than it ever was. And I think personally I've benefited from it. It's been I think of it all as a net gain.
Now, moving to navigating the city, you're saying it's a great city, San Francisco, to get around.
Yeah.
Did you feel vulnerable when you first started traveling?
Well, of course, you know, that first time you have to step off the curb on your own to cross the street at a busy intersection, yeah, that getting that foot to go off the curb and actually hit the asphalt, that's a scary moment. But it's something we all sort of push through. And the nice thing about San Francisco is that, especially in downtown where my office is that the streets aren't that large and it's not messed up by a whole bunch of freeways moving through it. It's actually a very delightfully pedestrian scaled city. Now, the streets tend to be pretty busy with traffic, but it's I feel pretty pretty safe, and I feel like it works pretty well.
And do people react differently to you? Do you find your experience as a blind person going through town different to what it was when you were sighted as far as people's reactions?
Oh, absolutely. On a couple different levels. On one, you know, I'm grew up in the southeast of the United States in Tennessee and North Carolina, where it's common for when you pass people on the street, you say hello. And, you know, good morning. And it's a very social engagement with strangers that you pass wherever you go. And that doesn't happen so much in California and San Francisco. But it's funny, the same streets, the same places I used to go, you know, now people just come up. They may not say hello, but they might ask if you need help, or if they could assist in any way, or they might, as you're going across the crosswalk, approaching the curb on the other side, they might tell you that the curb's there, like you wouldn't find it with your cane, but you know, they're just trying to help. and I've actually kind of liked that, being someone that sort of grew up with a more socially engaged experience with strangers and people, and I try to turn those things where people assume that I need help, I try to just turn it into a normal conversation and enjoy a chat with somebody on the street. So and that works pretty well, and I enjoy that. So that's been sort of socially a big change for me, you know, walking the streets.
That's Chris Downey speaking there to Simon Pauly. More from Chris coming up later.
RNIB Connect is a growing community that brings together everyone affected by sight loss. And you can now connect with the community online. Share your thoughts in blogs and discussions and hear great stories from across your community, including friends, families and carers. Best of all, it's free to join. Discuss anything from tech and travel to work and parenting. Your RNIB Connect online community is a space for everyone to share local news and information and bring people with similar experiences together. Your contributions will really help to bring it to life. So, join in the buzz at rnib.org.uk/connect. Or to find out more, speak to your Connect team. Email connect@rnib.org.uk or call 0303 1234 555.
The Weekly Connect. The Weekly Connect. On RNIB Connect Radio.
Coming up later, great story of a charity that's helping blind children to learn music. Wonderful story coming up here on The Weekly Connect. Stick around for that. Now, Red Sail is a man who clearly likes hats. I say that because he wears so many. He's an author. He hosts RNIB Connect Radio's Read On Air program each week. And if that's not enough, he's a rock climber. Well, we were keen to find out more about that last one. So Red decided to take our reporter Leanne Coyle along to his local climbing centre in London to show her the ropes. Ropes. Get it?
Red, hi, I'm Leanne.
Hi Leanne, how are you?
Pleased to meet you.
Good to meet you.
So here, you're going to take me climbing then?
Yep, off to the castle.
Great, so it's just a few minutes walk from here, isn't it?
It is, very close.
Okay, great, let's get going. Just as we're making our way to the climbing centre on this really horrible rainy afternoon in London, tell me a bit about your level of sight. How did you lose your sight?
Well, I've got retinitis pigmentosa, which I was diagnosed with when I was 19. I guess I've probably lost about 97% of my sight. I can still distinguish between light and dark, but I can't see any detail. It's all very hazy and it's a bit like looking through a keyhole into a smoke-filled room. I get glimpses of parts of things, but they have to stay still for quite a long time for me to be able to work out what they are. So looking at rock faces is kind of ideal because they don't move very much.
Rock faces for climbing, of course.
Yes, so it's gone gradually over the last nearly 30 years, so I've had time to get used to it. It's just frustrating, really. I think anybody who has experienced gradual sight loss would know exactly what I'm talking about. You lose the ability to do things that you used to be able to do. What I like about climbing is that actually it's not just a visual activity. There's a lot of feel and balance, and there is the potential to improve, which kind of I feel helps in the battle against the frustration of losing my sight.
Were you a climber before you started to lose your sight at the age of 19?
Well, I started rock climbing when I was about 13 at school. You know, I was getting quite good by the age of 18, 19. But when I got my diagnosis, I thought, well, if I can't trust my sight, how can I expect other people to trust me? So I hung up my harness and sulked for about 20 years. And it was only because my daughter wanted to have her 9th birthday party at a local climbing wall, 2009, that, you know, I got to the wall and the other parents were sort of ogling these, you know, buff-bodied climbing instructors, and I was off groping the bumps and curves on the climbing wall thinking, oh, I've missed this. And I spoke to the climbing instructor and he went, well, I can't see that being blind's going to make any difference. So he took it as a challenge to improve his teaching abilities, and I took it as a challenge to try and lose all those pounds that I put on in the 20 intervening years. I'm quite an advocate that anybody who's got a climbing wall near them should just give it a go.
Excellent. Well, that's what we're going to do today, and we've just arrived at the Castle Climbing Centre. in North London. Let's get in and get harnessed up and get on a walk.
Thank you.
Here we are.
The sound of a busy climbing wall. Right, so we need a harness around our waist, which we loop the rope through. We'll also need a belay plate and a carabiner. To put the rope through. Climbing shoes are always a good idea, although you can climb in trainers as a beginner.
Okay, so we're harnessed up. We've got our carabiners, we've got our water. Let's get to the wall.
Fantastic.
Red looks about 20 feet. Is that about the normal size? I mean, I can see there are other much taller walls around.
Yeah, 20 feet is a good one to start off on, assuming that it's got a relatively straightforward route on it. Does it say what the grade of the route is anyway?
It does. So at the bottom, we've got black is 4, green is 4 plus, yellow and purple is 5, and blue is 6A.
So a 4A would be a nice, easy starting route, which wouldn't involve anything too gymnastic and which will have good positive holds to hold on to. So a 6A is, you know, it's going to be a tricky climb. I enjoy climbing 6As and 6Bs, but can't climb a huge amount more difficult than that. So I think if we start on a 4 just to warm up on.
Excellent. Let's do it then.
Okay.
Red, you were saying earlier that when you climb up a wall, someone has to be at the bottom belaying you.
Yes.
Basically, their weight is countering yours. So if you fall off the wall, their weight will keep you safe.
They will keep you on a relatively taut rope so that if the climber falls, the inertia of the rope running through the belay plate in a sort of U-shape and the belayer's hand, in my case the right hand, will pull down on the rope and will arrest his fall, will stop him falling to the ground.
Just in the interest of safety, we do have another experienced climber here who is going to belay you. Jeremy, you're all harnessed up and ready to go. We're just waiting on Red securing his harness. So what have you got here?
There's a carabiner here that clips onto your harness, and then we've got a belay. So the rope goes through that, and when I pull down with my hands the loose end of the rope, that locks the rope, so no one can fall, no one can move at all.
So, Red, you want to do the 5 as a warm-up. Now, I'm reading the chart and it says that's the yellow and purple swirls. I can quite clearly see the holds dotted up the wall here, but how are you going to find them?
Well, this is where you and or Jeremy come in very useful. One of you is going to be my spotter. The system that I use is a clock face system. So if you imagine my tummy button is the centre of the clock, when I reach up with my right arm, I'm reaching up for anything between 12 o'clock and maybe 3 or 4 o'clock. You can direct me that way. Likewise with the feet, they obviously are the sort of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 o'clock. Takes a bit of getting used to, but we should get there.
I might rely on Jeremy to help me out with this one, him being an experienced climber.
That one. That's it.
Okay, up you go.
Right, that one? Right hand down, that's it.
That
left, left hand, that's about 10 o'clock. So further to the left, so and down. That's your next one. And left foot straight up at 11 o'clock.
Left foot?
Yeah. That's it. Yep.
Okay, so you're just letting Red down the wall now, Jeremy? Yeah,
yeah, slowly lowering him down.
It's almost like he's abseiling back down, isn't he?
That's right. You just need to shuffle your hands down the ropes. You've always got control of the rope. There you go.
Great.
Well, good climb.
Excellent. Nice. How was that for you?
That was very good fun.
You mentioned on the way here that when you found out about your diagnosis of retinitis pigmentosa, you thought that was it for you. And in fact, you did give up climbing for
20 years.
20 years. So coming back into climbing, how did you have to amend your climbing style?
I think the difficult thing is that actually I do a lot more hanging around in between the moves than a sighted person, because I'm waiting for instructions and I'm having to, you know, process those instructions, work out what's there, grope around for the hold, to be honest. You'll have seen us moving my hand around in spirals looking for the right hold. All that's pretty hard on especially the arms, if you're hanging off one arm trying to find the next hold. So I do a lot of strengthening exercises, a lot of arm work and forearm work, that's where, and finger work as well, just to make sure that my arms are strong enough. I always say I'd probably have to be about 115% as fit as anyone else, just because I spend, you know, at least 15% more time hanging off the wall than anybody else. It's very, very good for my balance. My balance is one of those things that I have progressively lost as my sight has gone.
A lot of people who lose their sight do struggle with it, is balance, and it's helped for you.
That's right. I mean, climbing makes me concentrate on putting my weight evenly through my feet, on standing properly. I do a bit of yoga as well, which also helps with my balance. And actually, yoga and climbing are very similar in that way. So actually, I've found climbing very beneficial to my general mobility.
No, after 20 years of not climbing, you got back into it and you achieved a lifelong ambition of climbing the Old Man of Hoy.
Yes,
in the Orkneys.
That happened in 2013. I'd fallen in love with the idea of climbing the Old Man of Hoy when I saw a documentary about Chris Bonington's ascent of it. He was the first person to climb it. And I thought, wow, that's a kind of a cathedral of rock, and it's in the UK, and I want to go and climb that.
Give us an idea of the scale of this wall. I mean, what is it like?
It is 450 feet tall. It's, for those who have sight, it's kind of the shape and size of the London Gherkin building. It is an enormous pillar of rock. It's the size of a sort of 40-story, a 24-story block of flats. And the Old Man has a huge bulging belly in the middle that you have to climb out of a crack and over this bulging belly, and then you climb on. And it's a tough climb. It's this pillar of rock rising out of the Atlantic, off the Orkney island of Hoy.
So you'd have to deal with wind as well, I'm sure.
We were very lucky. We got quite a calm day. But there's wind. There's all sorts of seabirds that like to nest on it. And things called fulmars, which are seabirds that have a very nasty habit of regurgitating their fish supper all over your head when you get too close to them. They can projectile vomit up to a metre and a half.
Oh,
you might not want to put that in the show.
If you didn't have enough to contend with.
It took me 5 hours to climb. It was quite a mission.
Well done. Now, what we're standing in front of is not quite the Old Man of Hoy, but I'm going to give it a go anyway.
Fantastic.
I'm harnessed up, ready to climb.
Taking the rope, so you're on belay.
Excellent. So if I fall, you will catch me.
Yes, absolutely. but you're not going to fall, because it's a nice straightforward route. First, identify two good footholds.
Okay, right.
And two comfortable handholds. So
okay.
Handholds where you feel comfortable. You're not stretching too far.
Okay.
You're actually in balance.
Okay.
And then you're moving one limb at a time.
Yeah.
So you should always have 3 points of contact. So
decide always what, have 3 points of contact.
Yeah. Decide what you're going to move first.
Mm-hmm.
See your next hold. Then I tend to move a leg up every time I've moved an arm.
Okay.
If I can.
Right. Excellent. Oh wow, I feel quite high up here.
Yeah, fantastic. Take a breath and then work out where you're going to move your hand or foot next.
Okay, up.
Okay, Leanne, just out to the left and move on up. Nice smooth movement, well done. Nearly at the top. Well done, that was a fantastic climb. Oh. Are you hooked?
That was really, I have to say I was pretty scared, even though you said this isn't a very tall wall, but I was very scared at the top, but the feeling of being up there is amazing. I think I'm definitely going to hang back in the climbing centre and try out a few more walls.
Well, fantastic. When you want to go and climb the Old Man of Hoy, you know where I am.
Yeah, next step, the Old Man of Hoy. Thanks so
fantastic.
Much, Fred.
Thank you.
Red Sail there showing Leanne Coyle how to rock climb. I am so glad he never asked me to do that. You can hear from Red every week on Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, Fridays from 1 p.m, or check out his podcast on your favourite podcast app or website.
Join RNIB Connect and become part of a wider and stronger community led by blind and partially sighted people. Membership is free, and it's the best way to keep in touch with things that are of interest and help to you. You'll receive Connect Magazine, our monthly membership publication, in your chosen format, as well as having the chance to be amongst thousands of like-minded blind and partially sighted people, friends, families and supporters. You'll also be able to take part in and organise social activities in your area, campaign for change and improve the lives of people with little or no sight, and get help from a dedicated RNIB Connect support team. It couldn't be easier to join RNIB Connect. Simply complete the online form at rnib.org.uk or join over the phone by calling 0303 1234 555.
The Weekly Connect.
The Weekly Connect.
On RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks for tuning in. This is The Weekly Connect. I'm Stephen Scott. Hello. We got a lovely email this week from Maritza, who got in touch. She said, hello to The Weekly Connect team. I am Maritza Medina. I'm a Colombian blind person who is currently living in Swansea in Wales. It was a pleasure for me to discover your podcast. Really, I didn't know anything about you until I found the link on the website of RNIB. I want to congratulate you for the podcast. It is very enjoyable and it always brings much interesting and useful information to me. It's a pity for me that I have to go back to my country very soon, because I'd have liked to know more about you and obviously all the different projects that RNIB does, and unfortunately I can't explore any further. It's nice to listen to you and get the different ideas, opinions, contributions, among other things, that British blind people have for living and how to make the best of their conditions. I have listened to some episodes. Probably very soon I will finish listening to them all, and I hope to go on hearing more in my country through the podcasts app. I only wanted to say hello, express my pleasure for a podcast like this, and really I will go back to my country a little jealous for all the things you can do to make life better every day for blind and partially sighted people. All the best to you, and excuse my English. Nowadays I'm continuing to learn more and more. You know, for blind Spanish speakers, it's kind of hard to learn your language because we don't have access to any material to recognise the different symbols you use to pronounce your words that are very different from the writing. That's also complicated when you don't read enough as well. Again, best wishes for you, and I hope I can get in touch with you to also share my experiences when I get home to Colombia. Well, we really do appreciate that email. That is a lovely email to get, Maritza. Thank you for tuning in. And yes, you can always listen to us wherever you are in the world. Do check it out on the podcast. And best of luck for your travels home. Now, earlier, you heard Chris Downey talk about losing his sight back in 2008. He told us how he adjusted to getting around without sight and how he managed to continue working in his daily job as an architect. Chris now continues his conversation with Simon Pauly and talks about how losing his sight impacted on his relationship with his family.
Now, going back to your home life, you know, it must have been really tough on your wife, I would say, and you know, your expectations of being a father as well. There's so many things going on there, aren't there?
Yes. And I think that's something that people often forget and sort of leave out of the equation. And it's definitely a difficult experience for my wife. It changes a lot of the logistics around the house, especially initially with things where when you don't have the skills and all of a sudden, you know, there's one less driver in the house and all the same things got to happen. And, I quickly got around to doing some chores around the house and was moving around the house fine. But, it changes things. It also the stress of what does this all mean? What does it mean financially? What does it mean about our future and things? So there's a lot of questions. And then there's the it's sort of like having another child, having to let go of the kid to go out and do things on their own. And, you know, she can't be there with me. And so you have to break that sort of desire to protect, to get out and have the independence you need to get the training and progress in ways where you can be, independent. So that trying to break, get that freedom within a relationship with trust and love, you know, that can be a challenge and ask a lot of each other. For my son, he was 10 years old at the time. And we actually sort of, I knew there was a problem with my sight when he and I were playing baseball, throwing catch with each other. And I realized I just couldn't see the ball coming at me anymore. And so we started on that odyssey together trying to figure out what's going on. He and I just went off to an optometrist and had my eyes checked and they couldn't figure it out. So he was at sort of the front end experiencing there's something curious going on. And but I think he handled it all really well through the surgery. And what was really fun was he enjoyed learning the things that I was learning. He was really, really curious and excited about it. He loved all the technology. He loved learning different ways of doing things. When I was learning Braille, he wanted to learn Braille with me. So he knows it visually. And he thought, you share the history of Braille and what that is. And it's, developed as that code to hand off behind the lines in with the French military and sort of share, have it more as a code and think of it that way. He was just fascinated by it and wanted to learn it. And so he'd just sit down and spend hours with me studying Braille or even walking the street. When I'd go out to practice walking around the neighborhood, he'd go with me, he'd grab a cane, he'd see what it was like. We'd cross the street together and I'd make sure he wasn't peeking to look to see what was going on. And, we just had fun with it. So I tried to share that experience with him, and he was a big motivating factor for me as well, because, I wanted him to have an active, fully engaged dad that was optimistic and was determined to go on about things and find new and wonderful ways to do things. So I think we all sort of adopted a really sort of strategy of working together and sharing it together in ways that could be fun.
And I think that's a thing sometimes that we forget about. We tend to think about it all from the person who's lost their sight or is losing their sight's point of view. But there's things that you lose, don't you, when you've been in a relationship with somebody who's sighted and you're sighted. I think you sometimes don't realise how many things we just say, oh, isn't that beautiful? Look at that sunset. Look at this. At least you have an appreciation of that. But for the person who's sighted, they've got to rethink your world, haven't they, and how you can still share things and enjoy certain things that were a visual thing before.
Right. And some of it is for, like, my wife, the, you know, the spouse that's still sighted, they have to be comfortable about how they talk about visual things or a beautiful sunset or just something that strikes them visually. And sometimes I know she would go through periods of feeling guilty about saying that, or should be she be saying that. Sometimes I was like, you know, I really don't care right now. But other times I do care. And, you know, it's interesting. She too is trained as an architect. And so we do a lot of work together now where, you know, we get to share some of those visual things, and I'll rely on her for some of that, for those things that I need that visual, some visual information on. So we had to get to that level of comfort of knowing how to share those visual experiences, and that she shouldn't feel guilty about it. And sometimes I have to be patient about it as well. It's like, I may not care, but it at that particular moment, but for the sake of the relationship, I need to care and sort of be part of her experience as well.
Now, for those that are listening, Chris, and I maybe even just setting out on this road of losing sight or lost sight suddenly, I mean, we're talking, this is only 8 years that you've been dealing with this as such. Yeah. What would you say to somebody who's facing that just now?
Well, you know, for each of us, it's different. For me, it was important to look forward and sort of face the challenge. And I think part of that is being trained as a creative person, as an architect, as a designer. You know, you get your design brief, your problem statement, you do your research, you build a plan, and you set about doing it. And there may be parts about that you don't like, but their chances are they're beyond your control. And so you have to accept those things that are beyond your control and then get set on about making something beautiful out of that problem statement after, you know, out of the material, the things you have to work with. So to the greatest extent people can do that, at least in my case, that was very helpful. Now, I just recognized that I was in an unusual place where I could have the perspective of a dad who passed away from something similar when I was quite young. I was 7 years old. And to then have the chance of going through something similar but only losing my sight, I could say, oh, that was trivial. And I didn't dwell on it. And I wanted to just keep pushing forward. But somehow or another, having that ability to not look backwards, not to regret what happened, or even to the extent of spending a lot of time and energy chasing after things that quite might heal you or whatever from the situation, sometimes that sort of keeps you looking backwards, or some you know, especially in the U.S., it's a litigious environment. Some might say, well, why don't you sue the doctor? Well, that's just looking backwards, and it might put some cash in your wallet, but it's not going to help your life. It's not going to get you to where you need to be in terms of your training. So I'm always about looking forward, finding creative solutions, and quite frankly, enjoying the process and looking for those magical moments of wonder and sort of enjoying these things that you didn't necessarily think you could do. And then you realize, oh, I'm doing it. It's and building on that promise, on that excitement.
So would you say that something that most people would deem as a negative experience has actually had many more positives than you would have ever dreamed of?
Absolutely. There's so much more positive that I've gotten out of this than I've lost. And I tend to think, when many think that I might have been unlucky in the big picture, I feel like I've been incredibly lucky. I've had good opportunity. Our family has handled it well. Our community has handled it well. I have a more meaningful place in the profession. I feel like I'm contributing to the profession in ways far beyond what I used to do. And as an architect, you know, I got into this profession wanting to make the environment, wanting to make the world a better place. And yeah, I'm doing that. So my sort of work towards that goal today is so much stronger than it was. So it's hard to imagine. There are times I work harder, and the financial rewards aren't as easy. And I have to work things different ways, but that's coming together. And in the total picture, it's all been incredibly positive. And I really feel like I've grown a lot as a person and as an architect.
Chris Downey there, talking openly about losing his sight and the impact it had on his family, life and career. We want to thank Chris for being so willing to come on and talk about that. Now, finally this week, we get back to doing what we love here on the Weekly Connect, and that is telling you about some of the wonderful organisations out there doing what they can to support people who have sight loss. This week, our Society of the Week is the Amber Trust, which aims to help children with sight loss learn about music.
My name is Julia Walport. I'm chair of the Amber Trust. I'm responsible for running it on a day-to-day basis, working closely with my fellow trustees, and in particular, Professor Adam Ockleford, who originally founded the Amber Trust. The Amber Trust was founded in 1995 to help blind and partially sighted children all across the UK who have a talent or love for music. Our vision is that blind and partially sighted children, including those with additional disabilities, should have the best possible chance to meet their musical needs and aspirations and to fulfil their potential. Amber's the only charity working throughout the UK dedicated to supporting children in their pursuit of music. And we're passionate about promoting a lifelong love of and participation in music, regardless of disability. Our core activity is providing grants to individual children. The grants can be for instrumental music lessons, music therapy sessions, the purchase of musical instruments or items of specialist music technology, perhaps tickets and assistance to attend a concert, or travel and accommodation to access opportunities for making music. Last May, for the first time, Amber held a concert. Rather than just having a fundraising concert with professional musicians raising money for Amber, we decided that it would be wonderful if we could combine professional musicians with some of our supporters and some of our beneficiaries. It was wonderful to see those with normal vision and those with impaired vision playing together. And this year, we have another concert, which is on the 14th of May at 3 p.m. at St. Paul's School in Barnes. Details are on our website, and tickets can be bought from there. But this year, we have a range of our beneficiaries, and even more than we had last year. So there'll be Anna Fu, who is a 16-year-old flautist who was the first blind child to play in the National Children's Orchestra. The Amber Trust has supported her flute lessons since she was 8 years old. Ashley Turley was born very prematurely and is blind with other difficulties, but is a very, very exciting jazz pianist who, with support from Amber for her piano lessons and also saxophone lessons, is really maturing and developing into a very impressive musician. There's another boy, Ivan, who is partially sighted, and the Amber Trust bought for him a sight pad, which is a digital sight reading machine, which allows music to be blown up, but also enhanced in different ways so that he can read it. And this has transformed, he's a cellist and a pianist, and it transformed his ability to take part in ensembles and other activities. Professor Adam Ockleford was working at Linden Lodge School in the early 1990s and had first met Derek Paravicini and nurtured his musical talent through his early years. Derek himself is blind, profoundly disabled and autistic, but an extraordinarily talented musician. And in 1995, a group of parents, including Derek's parents, approached Adam to ask what could be done in the future, because they were concerned that their musically talented children would not have anywhere to go when they left Linden Lodge. The Amber Trust was originally formed to build a unit called Soundscape, which was attached to an RNIB college in Surrey. And there, these teenagers had the opportunity to use music technology and develop their skills. Unfortunately, when the school closed, Soundscape also closed. And it was then we began to give individual grants to individual children. And we've now supported nearly 600 children. We currently support just over 200 throughout the United Kingdom. And a number have gone on to have careers in music. Lloyd Coleman, who we first supported with the technology in order to compose, is making a very successful career as a composer and a clarinetist. Rachel is currently at the Royal Welsh College of Music. Jamie is at Manchester University reading music. So it's very exciting that for those with talent, Amber can help nurture that talent, hopefully allowing them to have a professional career in music later. But for other children we support who have other abnormalities, then the music can become a lifeline in a different way by helping them communicate with their families. It may for some of them be their one form of relaxation that they enjoy. And so music therapy can be very beneficial for other children who are more socially isolated, learning to sing or learning to play the recorder or an instrument that they can then take part in a group with their peers, gives them an opportunity to join in when perhaps they find it difficult to take part in sport or other activities.
My name is Velma Krecht. My daughter is Mahalia, and I became involved with the Amber Trust as a result of applying to them for a grant to support Mahalia with her violin lessons. Well, I'm visually impaired, and my daughter is also visually impaired. Mahalia's condition is not the same as mine. She's partially sighted, whereas I'm registered blind. She loves singing. She loves music, full stop. Anything to do with music is her passion. She's always sung at home, but she started violin at school. In order to nurture her talent, I used to take her to the RNIB Music Advisory Services workshops for several years. So when my finances changed, because I'd heard about the Amber Trust from the RNIB, I then approached them to see if they would support Mahalia's violin lessons, and they did. The Amber Trust have also supported Mahalia by way of buying her a violin, and she's been playing that for several years now. And I've also had some information from them with regards to looking at an electronic means of reading sheet music. And I was really, really, really pleased about that because, well, it enabled her to continue with her lessons, and it didn't mean that, you know, I'd have to make further sacrifices, which would have been the case if I didn't have the support from Amber. Mahalia wants to go on the X Factor. She wants to be a singer, but she plays the violin and she plays the piano. She is now trying to do compositions. She's just entered for Battle of the Bands in her school, which is an amazing thing, considering that last year she took part in the first concert, 21st anniversary concert for the Amber Trust, and she was so nervous. She was so nervous. But when she actually did it, when she completed it, it was such a transformation. She just changed. She was so nervous at the thought of performing in front of other people, but she's capable. But this year, as a result of doing that, she's now taken the initiative and said, now I'm going for the Battle of the Bands. And she's playing the violin and singing as well. That's wonderful. Her confidence has snowballed, I have to say, leaps and bounds. She's quite shy. And I think having a visual impairment in general can be isolating if you don't have a connection. And I think that's what the music does. It gives her a connection to other people that she might not, you know, she wouldn't talk to anyone. And she's still quite, you know, she'll sit in a group and she'll still be reluctant to talk to someone, but play music or let her play something and it's a completely different scenario. It opens up, it just makes her more confident. And I've certainly seen her grow thanks to the support of the Amber Trust. And she's actually, as well as wanting to be a singer, she's just looking at her GCSE options. Music is in there, and she's aiming to go to university to study music, hopefully. And I think with Amber's support, she will do that. What the Amber Trust has done for me, I think for someone to really understand, it's if you're visually impaired and you're standing at a bus stop and you're waiting for a bus to come and you cannot see that bus, you want someone to come along and say, well, I'll tell you. And to be in a situation where someone not only comes along, tells you what the bus is, or waits for you, and then puts you on that bus is what the Amber Trust has done. In that, it's such a wonderful feeling that somebody can do that for you. And they enable you to make the journey. And that's what the Amber Trust is doing for Mahalia and for other children, other talented visually impaired musicians.
The best way to contact the Amber Trust is via our website, www.ambertrust.org. We are also active on Facebook and on Twitter.
That is our Society of the Week this week. The Amber Trust, helping get more blind children into music. Fantastic organisation. We'll have another Society of the Week for you next week. And if there's one you would like to nominate for the programme, then please do get in touch. Our email address is rather simply theweeklyconnect@rnib.org.uk. If you want to get in touch, please do tell us about a subject that you would like to be hearing about on the programme, or indeed something you might want to talk about as well. Coming up on the show next week, more Connect in the Community. We'll be out and about with our intrepid reporters taking your temperature on the world of sight loss. And if you're into astronomy, I encourage you to listen to the show next week, because we may have something special for you. In the meantime, don't forget, we're always available as a podcast 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on your favourite app or website. It could be iTunes, could be Audioboom, Overcast as well. If you've got that app on your Android phone, get the podcast, search for The Weekly Connect on those devices. And don't forget as well, if it's Monday at 1 o'clock on RNIB Connect Radio, it's The Weekly Connect. Thank you for taking the time to listen. More next week at the same time.